Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Wayne Moyer, professor of political science, also department chair of policy studies at Grinnell College. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
In our AIM studio, we also welcome Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dave, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Want a big welcome to our listeners as well. Join our conversation this hour. We'll be dashing through a number of developments on the political landscape. If you have a comment about any of them, make sure you raise it. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk more in depth about Mayor Pete, as he likes to call himself, Pete Buttigieg. He's emerged seemingly out of nowhere, risen in the polls both in New Hampshire and here in Iowa. Grant Gerlach of Iowa Public Radio was at a rally he held yesterday in Des Moines. I think it attracted about 1,500 people. We'll talk with Grant and hear some audio from that rally a little bit later in the program. We'll talk about sanctuary cities back in the news and what the money race indicates about the candidates in the 2020 race. But Dave and Wayne, let's first talk about the results of the investigation by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, that will become public tomorrow morning in a nearly 400-page report, some redactions, an edited version. We don't know the extent of those redactions. A reminder, this comes nearly 2 years since the start of this probe. Hundreds of search warrants, 2,300 subpoenas, 34 indictments. In a four-page letter last month, the Attorney General, William Barr, said that the special counsel did not find anyone associated with the Trump campaign worked with the Russian government to illegally influence the election. And he said there was also insufficient evidence that Donald Trump illegally obstructed justice. Wayne, let me turn to you first of all. What will you be waiting for? The primary questions you have in your head on the eve of the release of this redacted report?
Well, the thing that I'll be most interested in is on the obstruction of justice side of things. Apparently, the Mueller report made arguments both for obstruction of justice and against. And Barr, of course, didn't think that there was enough evidence to press charges. But there's an awful lot of things that might be regarded as obstruction, but are not sufficiently strong in terms of leveling charges against the president. And so I will be looking forward to see just how much evidence there is in the reports in terms of the president attacking the Justice Department, attacking the head of the FBI, and other government agencies that could be considered obstruction.
Mm-hmm. Reading from the Fox News website, evidently the president's legal team is preparing to issue a rebuttal to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report for tomorrow to refute any allegations on this exact point. Wayne, the obstruction charges against the president. Dave, also, will you be zeroed in on that or other aspects? There are many, a 400-page report, as you can expect.
Yeah, I feel bad for journalists across the country who are going to ruin their own Easter holiday by poring over this report all weekend.
Right.
I think what I'm interested in seeing is how much the summary report that William Barr put out matches up with the tone of the Mueller report. Because the Mueller report is really an in-depth investigation where they tried to uncover evidence of criminal wrongdoing. And just because they don't find sufficient evidence to prosecute or to charge anybody doesn't mean they don't find evidence of things that may be shocking to the public, may register as something we would call a scandal, and may warrant further investigation, not necessarily for criminal wrongdoing, but just for questions about what was going on. And the Barr summary really seemed to say there's nothing to see here. And I'm curious what happens when people actually read the content of the report, whether they agree with that or whether they say, well, that kind of actually looks like you're not being fully forthright about what this report says.
Mm-hmm. Central, the jumping off point, though, Wayne, back to you, was the issue of Russian hackers hitting the DNC and the Clinton campaign and the Russians influencing our 2016 elections, right? That will be in there as well.
Right, and I think that the evidence is very strong now, and the Mueller report is going to reinforce that evidence of the extensiveness of the Russian intervention in the campaign. So Trump denied that it took place at the beginning, but I think now the evidence is so absolutely strong that the administration, I think, will not be able to contest the Russian interference.
What about these other issues, Dave? For instance, the hush money payment scheme to keep two women allegedly silent about alleged extramarital affairs with Trump. This also part of this 400-page document?
Yes, it should be. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly the kind of thing that is going to probably spark the conversation for the next, not just days or weeks, but probably months, is the amount of evidence of just wrongdoing, whether it's criminal or not, is almost beside the point. It's the idea that a presidential candidate who pays hush money to a porn star who had an affair with him, that is something that the public would probably like to talk about. And it's been largely swept under the rug because the Mueller investigation was looking into it. And a lot of people said, okay, well, let's let the investigation go and see what they find. Well, this is our opportunity to find things and then start asking questions in a political manner of, is this the kind of behavior that we condone in elected officials? I think the Russian interference in the 2016 election is another good example of this. While the Mueller report may not show evidence that there was any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian interference in the election, if it documents that there's Russian interference, the next logical question is, okay, so what has the Trump administration done to protect us in 2018 and 2020, or have they just let this attack go unanswered?
Mm-hmm. More recently, the Attorney General Barr wants to investigate, he says, the origins of the FBI's counterintelligence investigation into Russia's election interference. Congressional Democrats want to scrutinize the decisions by the special counsel and the attorney general, as well as the Trump's own behavior. What about these actions to figure out, Wayne, how this whole thing got started and to see if that was the attorney general last week call it spying. That word was really, really jumped out here. Whether this whole probe was started legally and in accordance with the process of our intelligence community?
Well, it's a good question to ask, but in the back of my mind, I wonder how much this is just really to divert attention and to divert attention away from Trump and to try to focus public attention elsewhere. And so how much this probe on that Barr is wanting to conduct actually primarily political and take the heat off of Trump.
Okay, we'll know a lot more tomorrow at this time. As you said, Dave, journalists will be pouring through it. A lot of others will be pouring through this. Will Dave, do you think the public, will we get to see it at some point?
I would imagine so. I imagine this is going to be something that the public reads. Who knows, this could be the next New York Times bestseller when it comes out in print form, because I think the public is very interested. The public is always interested in the president, whoever the president is. And the public is also always interested in scandal, and this seems to be chock full of presidential scandals.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson is with us of Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about other big news this week, particularly here in Iowa. After more than a dozen years in Congress, representing Iowa's 2nd District, Dave Loebsack has announced his retirement after he completes his 7th term. We have to remember it was back in 2006, the former Cornell College professor, he knocked off longtime Republican Representative Jim Leach, a Republican, and that was back in 2006. Some analysts, Wayne, are seeing this district as a toss-up, the 2nd, now being eyed by Republicans as vulnerable, a vulnerable Democratic seat that they could take.
Oh, I think that's a possibility. On the other hand, I think it would be very difficult for a very conservative Republican to take that district. Jim Leach was a very liberal Republican. I think it is a toss-up. A lot depends on what the political atmosphere at the moment is, how strong Trump looks at that stage. And, of course, it also depends on who the Democrats and the Republicans pick. But I think it could go either way. My own sense is to give the Democrats a slight advantage.
Mm-hmm. I think it was roll call that changed it to toss-up. Do you agree with that toss-up ranking, Dave Anderson?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think the Cook Report has it as a D plus one, which means it's about one percentage point more than most congressional districts in the country. And if you're that close, it means that exactly what Wayne said is accurate. It depends on what who the candidates are who are running in both parties, and also what the tenor of the nation is. Iowa is becoming a great bellwether for the nation, where when the nation swings towards the Democrats, we adopt three congressional Democratic seats. But mm-hmm. if it swings back to the Republicans, that district is in danger.
Mm-hmm. And is there any way of telling at this point what 2020 will be like?
At this point, it still looks like the country is trending away from the Republican Party and President Trump, but we still have a very long time, and the president has not yet really begun a national campaign for reelection. And when he does, that may swing the needle back towards him.
My knowledge of this is a few hours old, so things may have changed, but have either of you heard of any names from either party who might get into that open race, a Republican or a Democrat, being put forward as possible candidates to try and take that second district seat? Dave?
I haven't, but I think Chris Peters, who just ran and lost in, I believe, 2016 and 2018.
Right, the last two times against Dave Loebsack, Christopher Peters, maybe in the race. That would probably be a good bet.
It's probably a logical choice that he would at least consider throwing his hat back in the ring. The district already knows his name. That helps him a lot. He's already had experience campaigning there. So he probably has a head start over the competition, but we'll have to wait and see if anybody else throws their hat in mm-hmm. the ring.
Any other names, Wayne, that you've come across?
Well, Rita Hart's name has come up, but I don't think it's clear yet who's going to get the Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm. Okay. She was the party's nominee for lieutenant governor last year.
Yeah.
Also, I've read the young State Senator Zach Walls mentioned on the Democratic side from eastern Iowa as well. We'll watch that, see which names are being put forward as well. Let's swing over to the 4th District, as long as we're talking about congressional races, where longtime Republican incumbent Steve King looks to face a stiff primary challenge. We have some numbers out. During the first quarter of 2019, the Republican State Senator Randy Feenstra raised more than $100,000 in its first 10 days. His campaign raised more than $260,000, more than four times the amount raised by Steve King. Dave Anderson, you're sitting in the 4th District there on the edge of it in Ames. Democrats have tried many times to topple King. Does it look like he may be toppled from within in a primary?
I think that is certainly the most likely scenario right now. It seems like Congressman King has lost the support of his own party. He's lost the support of a lot of his campaign donors. And he's in a really tough fight this year. And there's kind of the smell of blood in the water in the 4th District, that there are some really strong candidates who are seeking to oppose King in the primary. And whoever emerges from that may have to face off against J.D. Shulton again, or another Democrat who senses some vulnerability up in the 4th. It's going to be a very exciting primary and then general election, most likely.
Right. J.D. Shulton, memorable in the fact that he came within, 3 points of Steve King in a district that was won by Trump and King by as much as, 20 points?
Yeah. It seems like the voters in the 4th District really started questioning their loyalty to Steve King. And I think J.D. Shulton was able to take advantage of that in 2018, even though he didn't successfully win. But either way, you're either going to see a vulnerable Steve King against a Democratic challenger in 2020, or you're going to see a first-time candidate in perhaps Randy Feenstra or somebody else, which means they're just vulnerable. The 4th District should be a solid red Republican district. I believe it's an R plus 14. It shouldn't be in doubt. But anytime an incumbent may be toppled in a primary, that's a district in doubt.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson of ISU, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College Politics Wednesday. Let's look at some of the recent news we heard in the last day or two. This order issued by the Attorney General Barr yesterday, keeping thousands of asylum seekers in jail indefinitely as they await resolution of their requests. move seemingly aimed to deter immigrants from fleeing the violence, the poverty, asking for legal status in the U.S. It's an order, Wayne, let me get your thoughts on this. It goes into effect in 90 days, said according to reports, almost certainly to be challenged in court. So another way that this president is ratcheting down or ratcheting up, depending how you want to express it, immigration policy here.
Certainly that's true. I think Trump has a problem. He promised to stop the immigration. He hasn't succeeded, and that was a primary campaign promise. And this is another Hail Mary, I think, on the president's part to somehow or other do something that will actually slow the immigrant flow into the country. But again, I think this is legally highly challengeable.
Mm-hmm. Connected with this in immigration policy, that the president has threatened to relocate undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers to the so-called sanctuary cities in the U.S. These are the U.S.'s largest metropolitan areas. I don't think any cities in Iowa identify themselves as sanctuary cities. These are cities like Chicago, Seattle. Dave, comment on this. What's behind this? Is this simply an attempt to punish these cities who have sought to defy this hardline immigration policy from Trump?
Yes, absolutely. It's not seeking to solve a problem at all. It is seeking to cater to his base, and he believes he's going to cause problems in sanctuary cities by releasing people that he calls thugs and terrorists onto their streets. And I haven't seen any of these sanctuary cities really worried about this. It is just purely playing politics with public policy. It's not aiming to fix the immigration system. It's not going to correct any of the problems in America. It is just using the powers available to the president to punish people and to try to make good media stories that we can talk about and he can whip up his base.
Right. The reaction to some of these big city mayors is interesting. This is a quote from outgoing Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. America was a sanctuary country before Chicago was a sanctuary city. Send them. We'll welcome them and we'll enroll their kids in our schools. Rahm Emanuel, another one, the mayor of Seattle echoing these things. Wayne, I wonder, with these kind of pronouncements by big city mayors, could this backfire on the president?
I think there is a strong possibility that it will. On the other hand, I mean, as Dave is saying, Trump is trying to rev up his base and get more of them out in the 2020 election. So he may succeed in doing that, but it may also generate a blowback from Democrats to bring more Democrats out. So it could very well backfire.
Mm-hmm. Congress left Washington last week for a long recess. It left behind a key piece of unfinished business, funding for the millions of Americans harmed by hurricanes, wildfires, and also floods here in the Midwest. Let's listen to presidential candidate and U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. He says there must be a compromise on federal disaster aid package to help Iowa recover from historic flooding that would also help Puerto Rico. A $13.5 billion disaster aid package has stalled in the Senate.
We need to stop putting bills on the floor in the Senate that have no chance of passing in the House. It's got to be a compromise bill, and we can't plead poverty when we seem to have the money for billionaires and millionaires and corporations' tax breaks. We should also have money for struggling Americans.
Now, both Vice President Pence and the Republican Party of Iowa have criticized Senator Booker and other Democratic presidential candidates, such as Gillibrand, Booker, Warren, and Sanders, for coming to Iowa, asking for votes, but voting against disaster relief funding. They have argued that the measure didn't provide enough money for Puerto Rico, that the Democrats have, still recovering from that massive hurricane. Dave Anderson, make sense as much as you can of what's happening there to hold up the aid, including for those suffering from the flood disaster here in Iowa.
Again, a lot of this just seems to be politics. The Democratic Party is sticking to their guns and saying they want to guarantee more funding aid for Puerto Rico, which has just been devastated. And Puerto Rico was not in good shape before the hurricane, and it's in need of aid. These are American citizens, and even if this disaster relief isn't the solution, somebody has to come up with a solution because Puerto Rico is in a lot of trouble right now. And on the Republican side, they're arguing that Puerto Rico does not deserve this money. They should not be included in this disaster relief. And instead of sitting down and finding a compromise, which is kind of the job of Congress, the two parties are just being intransigent over it.
Mm-hmm. Quickly before the break, Wayne, do you happen to know how unusual it is for disaster aid to be tied up this way? You would think this would be the most bipartisan of any issue in Congress.
I think it's very unusual. And of course, since there were hurricanes in both Florida and North Carolina last year that are getting substantial assistance, and Puerto Rico was more seriously damaged, why should it get substantially less assistance?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back, we want to talk about Pete Buttigieg. Let's listen to a little bit of the audio from a viral video that's been going around the last day or so. The Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg, who's multilingual, offering his condolences in French. Listen to this. Following that massive fire at the historic Notre Dame Cathedral on Monday, here he is speaking to a French language news channel. This is Monday evening, Buttigieg addressing the people of France, speaking about the cultural significance of the cathedral.
Peuple de France, je voudrais dire que nous partageons la douleur aujourd'hui, que la cathédrale de Notre-Dame, c'était comme un cadeau à l'espèce humaine.
Okay, I don't speak much French, but it certainly sounds fluent to me. He said to the people of France, I would like to say that Notre Dame Cathedral is like a gift to the human race. We share in the pain, but we also thank you for this gift to civilization. These are just kind of spices that are interesting, Dave Anderson, when you have someone there on the spot pull out some French like that in a natural or a disaster striking the French people.
Yeah, it's always interesting for me, at least, to hear people who speak foreign languages and can just change from language to language. And for the people who have just suffered a disaster, I think it's always comforting to hear people speak in their own language. It just kind of makes the world seem a little smaller.
That's right. When we come back, we'll get in touch with Grant Gerlach of Iowa Public Radio. He was at last night's rally in Des Moines, where Mayor Pete, as he likes to call himself, Pete Buttigieg, was addressing climate change and addressing other issues. There was also some pronouncements by anti-gay protesters twice interrupting the rally. We'll hear some audio from that and speak with Grant Gerlach, who was on the scene yesterday. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. We'll ask Dave Anderson and Wayne Moyer as well, why is it that Mayor Pete has emerged seemingly out of nowhere and risen in the polls, both in New Hampshire and here in Iowa? We'll be back in just a moment with Politics Wednesday. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our analysts. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we're back with the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our two political scientists going through some of the latest developments. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I want to mention that tomorrow on this program, we'll be hearing excerpts from a presentation by world-renowned presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's due to be on the stage of Hancher Auditorium tonight. I'll be conducting, after her presentation, some Q&A with her, along with questions from the audience. We hope to air that tomorrow during the noon hour, expecting a full Hancher, about 2,500 people. Doris Kearns Goodwin, her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. It looks at the leadership qualities of four presidents, Lincoln, the two Roosevelts, and Lyndon Johnson. Should be an interesting evening. We'll bring you excerpts of the Q&A with Doris Kearns Goodwin tomorrow on this program. Dave and Wayne, before we get to your analysis about Pete Buttigieg, let's check in with Grant Gerlach. First of all, Pete Buttigieg seems to have come out of nowhere, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, formally launching a bid on Sunday for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. He likes to call himself Mayor Pete, also because the last name is hard on some people's tongues, I guess. He has gone from this obscure Midwestern politician to a top-tier contender in a matter of weeks. Polls not only in Iowa but also New Hampshire released last week showing him in third place in both of the early voting states, New Hampshire and Iowa, well behind, though, Biden, who has not yet declared, and Bernie Sanders. He's 37 years old, the youngest candidate in the field, a former naval intelligence officer, a graduate of Harvard University and Oxford University. He's a Rhodes Scholar and the first openly gay major presidential candidate. Grant Gerlach joins us now. Grant, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Ben.
You were at a rally of Buttigieg yesterday in Des Moines. Where was it?
It was outside a former middle school in Des Moines, and yeah, he definitely drew a crowd. It was supposed to be inside the building, but they expected so many people to come that they moved it outside, and the person who owns this establishment said that he estimated around 1,600 people were there.
Mm-hmm. Did you take notice of what type of people were there, ages, gender?
I would just say it's a wide range of Democratic voters.
Mm-hmm. Anything to speak of, noticing in the mood, the issues that the crowd responded to most?
They were just pretty generally fired up. You know, they were excited to be there and to hear what he has to say. He covered several different topics, but one of the main themes that he kept touching on was that Democrats need to talk about issues that in the past they've conceded to Republicans, in his view, things like national security and freedom. So just to give an example, he said health care, that's an issue that progressives could give their view of freedom on, for instance, health care access as an issue of freedom. So when it comes to regulating healthcare industries or drug companies, talking about that as an issue of freedom. The national security version of this was climate change. He said that it's an existential issue and a national security threat and should be treated that way. And so when he talked about a carbon tax, which is something he says he supports, that it should be in terms of national security, addressing a national security issue. So at the rally, he said, addressing climate change is a security issue, and it can't be solved by just spending more money on research.
The important thing about the carbon tax is not to take money out of the economy. It's to make sure that the pricing of things that have a long-term cost is actually reflected in the price you see.
Okay. Buttigieg, as I mentioned, is openly gay, recently married. His husband is Chasten Glesman Buttigieg. He's a 29-year-old high school teacher. I understand, Grant, that anti-gay protesters interrupted the rally in Des Moines yesterday?
Yeah, a couple times these men were standing up and shouting and kind of interrupting things. And I guess this happened earlier in the day. He seemed to be reacting in a way that he had seen this before. And the crowd started chanting to kind of shout down these protesters. They kept chanting his name. They kept chanting Pete.
Let's listen to a little bit of the audio of that rally by Pete Buttigieg in Des Moines last night.
Speaking of things, hello again. Speaking of things that are at stake that do not belong to a single political party.
Quite clear that Thank audio you collected there, Grant, and those couple voices in the back saying something like Sodom and Gomorrah. And then
remember Sodom and Gomorrah.
Remember Sodom and Gomorrah, then yeah. Chanting Pete there. Interesting. He also talked about the Electoral College.
Right. He said, and you know, I think maybe this is popular in some Democratic circles, that the president should be chosen just by popular vote. The thing is, Iowa is a less populous state. So even though it might be popular, given the results of presidential election in 2000 and 2016, Iowa, you know, it doesn't have as much clout in a popular vote as it does in the Electoral College.
Okay, thank you very much. Grant Gerlach, who was at the rally by Pete Buttigieg yesterday in Des Moines. Thanks, Grant.
You're welcome.
Let's turn to analysis now from Dave Anderson and Wayne Moyer. Wayne, how do you account for this rapid rise in the polls, given the background of this candidate, Pete Buttigieg?
he's very different than Barack Obama in some ways, but he's similar in other ways. This is a candidate of hope, candidate who's looking toward the future, candidate who is comfortable with a changing America. He has a great deal of charisma. He certainly is attracting young people. I think there are serious questions as to whether he will be able to get minority votes like Obama did, and how will he do in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, which are critical states for the Democrats to take. I don't know, but there's an excitement about him.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson, your read on Pete Buttigieg.
I think right now he's a really interesting candidate. I would just caution people that it's unlikely that he's going to maintain this momentum. Usually in a primary election where there's lots of candidates, there's kind of a flavor of the month where people learn about a new candidate who clearly has charisma and some interesting ideas, and the polls will kind of rush towards that person for a little while, usually about a month. And then people kind of get tired of them and start asking some harder questions about, well, okay, you have the ideas, you're interesting, but what's your experience? What's your background? And oftentimes, candidates who come from lower office, congressional office, mayors, after a few months on the national campaign trail, they tire out and they make some gaffes and mm-hmm. they tend to lose interest in the electorate.
Mm-hmm. What about, though, this, Dave, this activation that Wayne mentioned of perhaps Obama voters, the younger generation? Here's a quote from Buttigieg from a rally recently. I take that long view because I have to. I come from the generation that grew up with school shootings as the norm, the generation that produced the bulk of troops in the post-9/11 conflicts, the generation that is going to be on the business end of climate change for as long as we live. This is a millennial candidate speaking to the millennial generation.
Absolutely, and I think this is the future. I'm not sure that he is going to be the one who really puts the lightning in a bottle. Mm-hmm. He's got the charisma right now, and I think he's doing great. I think young people in this country are desperate for a candidate to rally behind. But I think we're going to cycle through a bunch of the candidates who are trying to target this population group.
How remarkable is it, Wayne, that less than 10 years after gay marriage, marriage equality legalized in this country, the Democratic Party might nominate, I mean, it's far from nomination, but okay, let's just kind of think out loud here. The Democratic Party could nominate a gay candidate, a man with a husband.
I think it is extraordinary. I don't think 10 years ago anybody would have imagined that, such as 10 years before Obama, no one would have imagined that we would have an African-American candidate. It does show how rapidly values are changing, at least in terms of minorities running for presidency, and now a person who is homosexual.
Mm-hmm. And also weaving into his rallies the mention about his personal life, he frequently mentions his husband, Chasten, and speaking of the struggle to legalize same-sex marriage, he says, our marriage exists by the grace of a single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court. So that puts a point on it, doesn't it, Dave? For Americans who have recently become married, same-sex partners.
Yeah, I mean, it's still tenuous. While I think public opinion has strongly swung behind gay marriage, there's a very weak Supreme Court decision that has granted it. And there are several states still that the majority of the population would like to deny the right for gay marriage. So it's tenuous still. It's not codified into something that I think we can have faith that is a permanent facet of America. It will be eventually, I think. But right now, it's still a little tenuous.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the money race. We had the first broad look at campaign finances here. The Democratic challengers to President Trump raising tens of millions of dollars in the first months of this, what is being called the 2020 presidential campaign. Of course, this is 2019. Senator Bernie Sanders coming up out on top with $18.2 million raised. Kamala Harris, $12 million. Beto O'Rourke, $9.4 million. And Pete Buttigieg, 7.1, Elizabeth Warren at 6, and down from there. Wayne, what does winning the money race at this point really mean? How much of a factor is it?
Well, I think the biggest factor is how big and how strong a campaign you're able to wage. How many people can you hire? How many television advertisements and other media advertisements can you actually produce? It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win, but it certainly gives you access to more people with more information, more campaign literature, and other campaign documents.
Mm-hmm. In the first 3 months of the year, Donald Trump raising more than $30 million and had more than $40 million in the bank. He and the Republican Party added another 100,000 small donors. When you look at these numbers, what are your thoughts, Dave Anderson?
Well, my thoughts right now looking at the campaign fundraising numbers is the impressive amount of small donations coming into Democratic candidates, whereas the bulk of the Trump money is coming from wealthy donors, which kind of resonates really with what we're seeing in the polls, that it looks like an enormous segment of the population is willing to just oppose President Trump and are giving freely in very small donations to Democratic candidates. And that is going to give those candidates the ability to get their voice out there mm-hmm. and test out their viability as candidates, which is a very different thing than sometimes we see in primary elections. Sometimes in primary elections, candidates have a really difficult time getting going, and they rely upon the elite donors, the very wealthy elite of the country, who get to hand pick which candidates can be viable by giving them large sums of money. And right now we're seeing something very different on the Democratic side. Kind of feels like the people's voice is coming out.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has a challenger in the party for the nomination. On Monday, the former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld officially launching his bid for the Republican nomination. He's the first challenger to Donald Trump for the nomination. He appeared on the ballot in 2016 as a Libertarian Party's nominee for vice president. This announcement came shortly after the Trump campaign re-election campaign announcing that big haul of 30-some million dollars. Wayne, what are Weld's chances of unseating President Trump from this nomination? Next to none?
I think next to none is right. He comes from the moderate wing of the Republican Party, and he certainly has the full party organization working against him. He has no appeal at all to Trump, I think, to the Trump base, which is the strongest aspect of the Republican Party right now. So I think the chances are almost zero.
So how do you, Dave, how do you interpret, if you agree with Wayne, how do you interpret the entrance of Bill Weld and others? He hasn't entered, but I certainly get email from John Kasich, a former candidate, seemed to be waiting in the wings for something perhaps to happen that would make President Trump untenable for the nomination?
Well, I think Wayne is completely right that Weld has no chance of getting the nomination. Even if President Trump decided to resign office and leave 2 days before the national convention, the convention would find somebody else who's more representative of the Republican Party right now.
But more in the mold of President Trump.
More conservative than Bill Weld. But it's debatable what really defines President Trump right now. He's not necessarily very conservative in his policy preferences because he doesn't have stable policy preferences. What he really has is a stable attitude and personality that his base seems to really like. And I think that is why Bill Weld and John Kasich are talking about getting into this race, because they want to remind the party that there are civil alternatives, that the Republican Party does not need to define itself by being obnoxious. And that's how a lot of people perceive the president. Usually when people get into a contest that they're not going to win, especially in a primary, it's an attempt to force their party to talk about things they care about. And I think with both Bill Weld and John Kasich, what they want to talk about is civility and the idea that we don't need to demonize our opponents and we don't need to consistently spin untruths and falsehoods in order to articulate a conservative message. That's, I think, what they're trying to do with their candidacies.
Let's listen to another Democratic presidential candidate who was in Iowa late last week. The Washington governor and candidate Jay Inslee spoke in Ames about climate change. This is his main campaign issue, which he says intensified the flooding on the Missouri River.
When you look at the science that's rolling in here about what we are facing, we're out of time. We've got to get a national mission statement to defeat climate change. And we in this room can be involved in doing that by getting a new president. And I can tell you we need that. There is 10,000 IQ points more in this room than exists in the White House today. I can tell you that. And we need to create a vision statement from the American presidency to really ignite the passions and abilities and innovative character of the American people. And I believe we can do that. And we need to do it right now.
Democratic presidential candidate Jay Inslee of Washington State. Talk a little bit about climate change here as we close as an issue in this 2020 campaign. We hear reports from around the world, climate change activists en masse being arrested after blocking roads in central London, for instance, protests aimed at shutting down other major urban areas. Wayne, do you expect to see the same political movement on this issue here in the U.S.? I think we're seeing it among some of the youth, even high school kids in some areas, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and it is developing in this country. And I think the big question is, how fast will the millennial and sort of post-millennial generation really, how fast will it take charge of American politics? I'm not sure we're there yet, but 10 years from now, they will be in charge, and clearly climate change is a very important issue for them.
Mm-hmm. Comment on climate change as a campaign issue, Dave?
I'm not sure we're there yet, but it's definitely coming. Public opinion on climate change actually tracks very closely to public opinion on gay marriage in some ways, in that every year more and more of the population becomes convinced overwhelmingly that climate change is real and we need to do something about it. The same thing was happening with gay marriage starting in 1995, and it took about 20 years, but finally public opinion started supporting gay marriage, and it happened quickly. I don't know if it's solidified completely into our political system, but with climate change, even now a majority of Republicans are reporting that they believe climate change is real and that something needs to be done about it. And with those numbers, it's inevitable that eventually our government's going to have to start acting.
Mm-hmm. In the final 2 minutes of our program, quickly, your views, gentlemen, on the controversy surrounding Ilhan Omar. This is the freshman Democrat from Minnesota in Congress, one of the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. This week, President Trump tweeted an edited video portraying Representative Ilhan Omar as playing down the 9/11 attacks. Omar said that is a tweet that has led to an increase in threats against her life. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi denouncing the president for invoking what she called the painful images of 9/11 for a political attack. She had asked the Capitol Police to assess Omar's safety. Omar here supporting the boycott of Israel movement is standing up to be critical of the state of Israel. Wayne, your thoughts on what is happening, why it's happening, and why Omar is such a focal point?
A couple of things. One, Trump is watching her, watching every step that she possibly makes, everything she says, in hopes that he can use that in terms of building support among his base. On the other hand, her use of language has often not been careful, and I worry somewhat that will undercut the effort to take Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, which the Democrats have to take to win the election.
Mm-hmm. Dave, does it appear to you the Democratic Party completely comfortable with defending Ilhan Omar?
I think so. I think President Trump has a history of attacking women, minorities, and Muslims, and he found kind of the trifecta in Congresswoman Omar. And he's just going to use her to continually attack and try to rally his base. And I think a lot of people in the Democratic Party are realizing that if he's going to rally his base, they can rally the other 55% of America about the fact that this is not okay, that we can be more decent as a society.
Okay, thank you very much. Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Wayne Moyer, Professor of Political Science and Department Chair of Policy Studies at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Wayne and Dave, always a pleasure to have you on the hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Ben.
Reminder again, Doris Kearns Goodwin on the program tomorrow. We'll have some recording of tonight's event, her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. That's at Hancher Auditorium, her appearance tonight. I'll be Having the pleasure of being on stage with her during the question and answer period following her presentation to pitch out some questions and also pass on some questions from our audience members. Starts at 7:30 this evening. I'm not sure how many seats are left, but you could check out the Hancher website, Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City. That starts at 7:30 this evening. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian, Leadership in Turbulent Times. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. Help today as well from Stephanie Nobrega. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.